Health and Human Services Committee to order. And one little housekeeping note, the committee, there will be no Friday hearing, so you have the day off. Kind of, sort of. And the first order on our agenda is 3394, which is the trauma bill that we tried to send to the floor, but we were unable to rescind the referral, so we need to bring it back to put the referral back in and then send it to Ways and Means. So the chair requests unanimous consent that the rules be suspended and consideration of House Bill 3394 be taken up immediately. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Chair requests unanimous consent that the motion on 3394 do pass as amended to the floor and rescind the subsequent referral to Ways and Means be reconsidered. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. The chair will entertain a motion on House Bill 3394 with a due pass as amended to the floor and be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
So moved.
Representative Tomei moves House Bill 33 with a due pass as amended to the floor with a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, clerk, call the roll.
Representative Anderson.
Excused. Excused.
Aye.
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 Excused. Aye. House Bill 3394 have been received the required majorities, declared passed. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 3394 and open a work session on Senate Bill 191. Sandy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 191 was heard on Friday, May 2nd. This was the bill that includes specific information about benign tumors of the brain and the central nervous system and types of conditions included to be included in the statewide registry system of the Department of Human Services. It requires clinical labs that diagnose cases of cancer or benign tumors of the brain or central nervous systems to report that information to the statewide registry. At that time, there was some amendments that had not been drafted. What you have before you are the dash ones. What we've done is included the phrase throughout the bill, benign tumors of the brain and the central nervous system, and there were numerous places.
If you're a member of committee, it was quite simply that it was a minor change, but it occurred so many places that we couldn't do it conceptually. So I would entertain a motion on the dash one amendment.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 191.
Representative Tomei moves the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 191. Any discussion? Any objections? The dash ones are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 191 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Tomei moves Senate Bill 191 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk, call the roll. Excused. Excused.
Aye.
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 Excused. Aye. Representative Anderson, do you want to vote on 191?
I heard a lot of ayes. Let's add one more.
Okay.
It's the dental bill.
It's just ownership this time, nothing else. So.
It's deep trouble.
Senate Bill 191, having received the required majority, is declared passed. Do we want to carry or consent it?
Consent.
Representative Tomei moves that Senate Bill 191 be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. And I will close the work session on Senate Bill 191 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 56. Sandy?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 56 comes to us from the Senate floor with a 20 aye vote, 5 no votes. The bill creates a planning and advisory committee on the continued promotion of financial education and financial self-sufficiency. It declares an emergency effective upon passage. It has a referral to Ways and Means by prior reference. We have before us the A2's amendments that address the fiscal impact and has removed and added clarifying language so that the Ways and Means referral may be rescinded if That is what the committee chooses to do, and we have a couple of folks here to speak to the bill and the amendments.
Janet.
We're going to have housing authority.
Oh, okay.
Janet and friends.
I'm glad you've got friends. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Cruz, members of the committee. Janet Carlson, Marin County Commissioner. Senate Bill 56, I'll give you a little bit of background on how the bill came to be, and then I've got Michael Parker from Treasurer's Office and David Foster from Housing that are here more to speak to the substantive issues of the bill. Last session, there was a bill based on an audit of the State Commission on Children and Families to remove the children's development accounts from statute. These are this was a process that was put into statute, I think, in 1989 or 1991, had never been implemented, but the idea is that children and families who are in poverty don't have an opportunity to build assets, and so they sort of live from, you know, subsidy to subsidy, and the difference between someone who is in poverty and someone like myself is that I get a credit limit, I can have a home equity loan and so on to be able to have assets in times of need. And how do you allow people to build assets for housing, for training, for things that can lift them from poverty into self-sufficiency and hopefully into a productive life? The Children's Development Accounts had that vision, but again, the State Commission on Children and Families didn't have the ability to implement the program. During session, I worked with Housing and Community Services because they have individual development accounts that they're actually implementing to try to merge it so that it would be a broader picture. Because of miscommunication in ways and means, a letter went from housing to legislative fiscal staff. They didn't understand that they wanted position authority, even though they didn't want money. It came to the Ways and Means Committee, and Senator Winters decided not to hear the bill, and so then the bill was dead. Okay. So at that point, we worked together and tried to put together a work group in order to try to figure out what we could do for the next session. So the paper that I handed to you includes the representatives that participated in the work group. We had four meetings over the course of the interim. Some of them were actually pretty close to or during special sessions. We identified a number of different programs that were operated that had the same intent. So there's, in addition to the ones that I mentioned, there's the refundable child care credit, there's the college savings account, there is individual education accounts that are in the Department of Human Services, microenterprise development that's in the Economic Development Department, and then I got involved with the senior task force, and there's long-term care insurance for people to save for long-term care and so forth. So you can see the different relevant programs that we identified. All of these programs, again, already exist in government. It's just that they're spread across different agencies, and it was interesting as we brought all the people to the table to talk about the programs, there was a lot of, oh, I didn't know you did this, and I didn't know you did that, and people trying to figure out how maybe we could work together better across the state to get to this common purpose of building financial education and financial self-sufficiency. We identified a number of policy issues. You'll see them listed at the bottom and the top of the first page of the handout that I gave you. We also identified some administrative issues, and one of the questions that I asked is, do we need legislation for this, or are these some things that we can actually do administratively? Through your different departments. At the end of the last work group meeting, what we determined was that we really didn't know at this point whether we needed legislation, except that people wanted to continue the conversation, that we'd just gotten to a point and we could continue on. So we decided instead to put together a bill, and it's loosely based on a bill that passed last session about a planning and advisory committee for children of incarcerated parents, which is one that I sponsored, and has similar language to it. We presented the bill on the Senate side. We were able to have them remove the subsequent referral to Ways and Means because the funding source would be gifts and grants. I volunteered to facilitate the meeting until they're able to get a grant to get a staff person. We also extended the time frame, so instead of having the report coming back at the before the next legislative session, it comes back in 4 years, so that gives us additional time to work on it and get it going. So we did a number of things to try to make it so that it would be possible to do it with a very minimal fiscal impact. Also at the last meeting, the Consumer and Business Services came to the to the committee and said that they have a program and wanted to be included in the bill. It was rather refreshing. I told them most of the time people are trying to get out of my bills rather than get in them. And so we added them to the bill, and they said that they have some funding sources that may be applicable to this work group. So we have some opportunity to work together during the next several years to try to build a better coordination for the concept of helping people become more financially literate. So with that, I'll turn it over to David to talk from his perspective, and then Michael.
Really the only thing that I need to share, my name is David, first of all, David Foster. I serve as a policy strategist at Oregon Housing and Community Services, Mr. Chair, committee members. The only thing that I understand remains as an outstanding issue with the bill is that there is some wording at the end of the bill that talks about continuously appropriated funding. And I wanted to convey to the chair and the committee members that the department is prepared to address this issue by actually accommodating potential funding sources, the outside funding sources that we may be able to receive for this initiative in our regular budget limitation so that the fiscal impact can be accommodated there. So I think that's the only thing that remains as an issue that needs to be clarified here. Conceptually, it's a good bill. We don't know where the funding is going to come from for sure at this point. The concepts, the working relationships that Janet shared with you are purposeful and positive, and so we are supportive of the concept and willing to work on it to make something very positive happen here.
And you're okay with the A2 amendments?
Yes.
Okay. Questions?
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Michael Parker, State Treasurer's Office. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon College Savings Network. I'm just here to convey the Treasurer's support of this bill today. The Treasurer has a very big interest in financial literacy and financial education. He's very committed to seeing that this happen. We use the College Savings Network and the College Savings Plans as a way to do financial education. We use that to get the message out that folks need to start saving for college, but also many other savings needs that folks need to look at. And because we work in this atmosphere, we see there's a great need for some sort of financial literacy. And so we'd love to see all the agencies that have some sort of financial education package get together and provide this statewide. Just as a quick example of something working on right now, we're working with the Social Security Administration and a couple of nonprofit agencies out of Washington, D.C., to bring a program to Oregon called Save for Your Future. And basically what it is the Social Security Administration is working to try to get folks to understand that Social Security is one part of your retirement needs. There's many other parts of your retirement. So the Treasurer is working on these sort of programs. This would be a great spot to plug into this sort of legislation to have other agencies help us out in this effort. So we're the Treasurer is very supportive of this bill and happy to answer any questions you may have.
Any questions? Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
And thank you for your work. I think this is fairly self-explanatory. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 56 and open the work session on Senate Bill 56.
Mr. Chair, I'm somewhat confused. So even though we have a fiscal statement here, this does not go to Ways and Means?
Right. We have it basically on the record from Housing and Community Development that is within the scope of their budget, and it will be addressed when their budget is being worked out in Ways and Means. So, and it's also from the perspective that this is a minor amount of money, and since we have it on the record that it will be addressed, it seems unnecessary to clutter Ways and Means with another bill that's a policy statement that's going to be addressed in another way in the budget package.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it does have a prior reference to Ways and Means on this side. And so with this A2 amendment, the sponsors are requesting that we rescind that.
It. But we would need a motion on the A2 amendments.
Mr. Chair, I move the A2 amendments to Senate Bill 56.
Representative Tomei moves the A2 amendment to House Bill or Senate Bill 56. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, the A2 amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 56 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Tome moves Senate Bill 56 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation, rescinding the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
That's what I meant.
That's what you said. I heard you very distinctly say that. Is there any discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Representative Anderson.
Aye.
Senator Barker.
Excused.
Aye.
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 Excused. Aye.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 56 to the consent calendar, please.
Representative Tomei moves that Senate Bill 56 be placed on the consent calendar. Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Senate Bill 56, having received the required majority, is declared passed. And I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 56. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 390. Colleagues, we could have a whole lot of testimony on this bill, but I'm not sure that it's necessary. Do you want to say a little anything, or do you care? Well, I know you care. I know you care. Colleagues, this is basically the dental ownership bill without the dental ownership in it. So this is all other components of it. Do you want to say a little something on the record? That'd be fine. Come on up.
And we will give you some written.
Okay. Ooh, we got a bigger list than I thought we would have.
Thank
Good
you,
morning.
Representative Cruz.
Go ahead.
Representative Cruz and members of the committee, I am Clayton Stearns. I'm a practicing dental specialist here in Salem. I'm a past president of the Oregon Dental Association as well as the Oregon Board of Dentistry, and I speak in favor of Senate Bill 390 as it is. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to move Senate Bill 390 along in the legislative process. This bill does represent work that was done by a group that met during the interim session at the suggestion of the legislature and at the request of the Board of Dentistry, and it does address all the inequities in the current law without jeopardizing patient protection. And I'll let Ms. Jane Anderson, or Ms. Jane Myers, explain the specifics of the bill, and I'm here simply to answer questions from a dentist's perspective.
Jane.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jane Myers, representing the Oregon Dental Association. We support Senate Bill 390. It's at our request to make certain that many of the volunteer groups and other low-income dental clinics could continue to operate within the law. Some of their situations were a bit cloudy since the law limits ownership of clinics to licensed dentists. Charitable work operations such as the dental vans operated by Northwest Medical Teams are not owned by dentists. And I think you have a piece of written testimony from Dr. Barry Taylor, who's on the advisory board for the Northwest Medical Team, supporting the bill as it's written. The bill removes any cloudy barriers to operation of clinics by charities, colleges and universities, the state, counties and cities, and federally qualified health centers. The language you have in front of you was negotiated with lots of wordsmithing by the parties to the work group that, and we support its enactment without amendments. If you would desire an explanation of what's in the bill, I know there was a lot of attention given to what's not in the bill previously, but I'd be happy to do so.
What would be the committee's pleasure? Do you want to have a walkthrough? Jane, I'll say we may have focused on one section of the bill, but I think over the course of all of our deliberations, we became familiar with the whole bill.
I also, in hopes I wouldn't need this, but I see that Mr. Davis for the Denturists and United Seniors is signed up, and I'm anticipating that you might like to have some information about Ballot Measure 24, which was enacted by the voters. It's about denturists doing partials. It has a section in there, which I've written here, copied it straight from the ballot measure, which is going to amend a part of the statute that has to do with the denturists and their licensing. And it says, a dentist as defined in ORS 679 0010, and a denturist may cooperate, maintain any business or professional association that is mutually agreeable, with each being responsible for their respective area of expertise. That's what's going into law. It's very broad. And I have heard on the Senate side there was a request by the denturist to be exempted from the provisions of the current licensing law. The Board of Dentistry's AGs told the Board of Dentistry executive that it's her belief that the wording in Section 3 of Ballot Measure 24, which I just read you, regarding cooperation and maintaining a business relationship, and the issues raised in Senate Bill 390 and House Bill 2964 are separate and distinct. The language in Ballot Measure 24 will be codified in the denturist statute and will be in effect no matter what happens with either of these two bills. And then Sue Wilson, who is the director of the Health Licensing Office, which has monitoring of the denturist board, said that her intent in raising the issue was not intended to exempt denturists from the restrictions against practicing dentistry, which pretty much was my understanding. That's exactly what the amendment would have done, and so we would not support an amendment like that and hope you would not add it to the bill, so that we would hope the bill could go through the process, which is now wrapping up kind of quickly. Without an amendment, we hope. And from a lawyerly point of view, what will happen with the two parts of the law that are distinct is they would be harmonized, you know, so that one doesn't cancel out the other. So, and we would hope that that could be done, you know, without any legislative direction at this point.
Any questions? Thank you both very much.
Thank you. Yeah.
Barney.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Barney Spade, Kaiser Permanente.
Have you seen the dash twos yet? I haven't.
Dash twos?
To that other thing.
No.
Okay.
Sounds like. Very briefly, Mr. Chairman, Kaiser Permanente and its dental health program support Senate Bill 390 in its current form. We were invited to participate with the Oregon Dental Association and others, including the Board of Dentistry, in the interim work. This is 7/8 of that interim work. We think it removes all of the clouds on various organizations that arose because of an attorney general's opinion, and just want to let you know we sort of support the bill.
Okay. Thank you, Barney. Jim.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Davis. I'm representing the Oregon State Denturist Association, the United Seniors of Oregon, and the Portland Gray Panthers. We wish to express our opposition to Senate Bill 390. We understand that it's a train that's coming down the tracks very quickly, and we're not attempting to put in any more amendments or anything like that, but we did want to have an opportunity to just express certain of our opinions around this issue. We feel that this places unnecessary limitations and controls on ownership in dental offices and clinics. It gives essentially those licensed by the Board of Dentistry unrestricted control of almost every aspect of dental clinics and businesses. We feel that this policy should be more open and flexible, allowing more access for non-dentists to take part in the ownership and operation of the business. Of course, today, and has been throughout this process, our chief concern has been that of the denturist profession, which is under a different statute, and I'm glad that that was clarified by Jane Myers. And certainly we wanted to express our perspective on the intent of Measure 24 as passed by the voters by a 3-1 margin in the last election. Jane read the passage that I was going to read to you, and I don't think I need to read it again. But we feel that this statute, as was the intent of those of us that put this on the ballot, that this statute would allow dentures to own and operate a dental clinic with a dentist, that it establishes that denturists and dentists can enter into mutually beneficial business relationships, create strong collaborative relationship that we feel will help with any unnecessary delays and additional expenses and compromises to the quality of care to patients. We have tried, as Jane has indicated, from with a little different perspective than we might give, we have tried to place some amendments on both 390 and 2964 without success, and we understand that, and again, we're not trying to move that right now. Since these professions, the dental and insurance professions, are interrelated, it makes sense to create a more seamless environment. Business alliances between dentists and denturists have existed with success in Washington State, and there have been quality alliances here in Oregon. That said, I wanted to take an opportunity to respond to what we feel were degrading remarks about denturists that were made by Jane Myers at the last committee hearing on 2964. She made light of educational levels of denturists and questioned their ability to run a dental business. Denturists are not in any way trying to pretend to be dentists who have a very extensive graduate-level curriculum, but one that does not contain significant levels of education around denture technology or denture fabrication. Denturists are well-trained and the most experienced in the field of denture technology. They must complete a comprehensive two-year college-level program in denture technology and oral pathology that includes courses in histology, microbiology, physiology, pharmacology, pathology, emphasizing periodontology, dental materials, medical emergencies, geriatrics, professional ethics, clinical denture technology, and denture laboratory technology. They must also complete 1,000 hours of supervised field work. They are then allowed to take a state examination, which is a practical as well as written examination, and then they are licensed simply to fabricate full and partial dentures for the public. When asked about the educational opportunities for prospective denturists, Ms. Myers forgot to discuss, we felt, some of the options available to denturists. There is Bates Technical College, where a degree can be received in Tacoma, Washington. NAID is one of the most respected degree programs in British Columbia. George Brown is internationally respected with a distance education program. But also, there's equivalency requirements in the law that allow for completion of classes through certified dental assistants or hygiene programs through PCC, OHSU, Chemeketa, Lane, etc. The objective is to complete the topics that are needed for an individual to then go into the field and hopefully be licensed to become a denturist. Finally, denturists are also good business people. They run successful practices in Oregon. They cooperate with dentists with success in their local communities. In Washington State, they actually employ dentists and have successful businesses there. So we thank you for the opportunity to express our opinions on this matter and on Senate Bill 390.
Any questions?
Thank you. Jim, help me understand this. So this bill would not allow a denturist and a dentist to jointly own a business.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Tomei, it is a little unclear, but we were concerned about the tone that it was setting, about total control by a dentist in a dental clinic. And we were concerned initially, as we had communicated with the committee, about its potential conflict with Measure 24. I think all parties involved have made it very clear that we are in a separate statute. And that ultimately, as we well understand, if this matter is challenged, that it probably will have to be brought to a court of law and definitions made there. We were hoping to clarify it in these pieces of legislation. But ultimately, there are probably still some questions that need to be answered around that. But our statute is distinct and separate, and as we have defined in this testimony, we feel that it does allow dentists and denturists to own dental businesses together.
And I follow it. So your concern is that this statute would limit that, would disallow?
Well, my concern is that there is potential with the way the statute is worded that it could cloud the issue even more if not properly clarified. And that was my concern.
Thank you.
Representative Juan Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I had the same concerns. It still will allow people to go to a denturist clinic and get their dentures.
Oh, yeah. It doesn't affect that in any way, Mr. Chair and Representative Mona Sanderson. We have separate statute. Our dentures have separate businesses that they run. I think what's at issue here is more the ability of a dentist and a denturist to own a business together. And what we see is kind of one-stop shopping where a consumer can be able to come in, see a dentist, and have their denture needs taken care of within the same operation.
Yes.
Yeah, right now a dentist and a denturist can be in the same clinic. I have a fellow
yes.
dentist who actually has a denturist working in his clinic, but the ownership is solely the dentist.
Yes, Representative, this issue is around ownership and control of a business.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Bonnie, do you have a clarifier on this?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Barney Spade, Kaiser Permanente. I do want to clarify something because this may be a disagreement among people reading the same bill. But I would point to the language on page 2 of the bill. The changes that are made in lines 27 to 33 are actually, I think, a clarification of the role of non-dentists in the ownership of tangible assets, in the employing or contracting of personnel other than licensed dentists, or in any of the management or business aspects of a dental office that doesn't include the clinical practice of dentistry. The intent of the language in 27 through 33 on page 2 is, in fact, to clarify that other persons than those licensed by the Board of Dentistry can participate in the management activities in the ownership of the assets of a clinic. So, I'm not an expert on how Ballot Measure 24 clarifies with this act, but I would point out that this act makes it, I think, much clearer and much more flexible for different ownership mixes, if you will, of the non-clinical aspects of a dental practice. And that was its intent.
Questions? Representative Tomei.
Thank you. So, Barney, as I understand what you're saying, then somebody who's not a dentist can own the building, can own the furniture, can own the equipment. They just can't own the records. Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, what you just said is correct. A non-dentist under these provisions can own in whole or in part the physical aspects related to the practice of dentistry. The dentist, in his or her clinical situation, remains responsible for and the owner of the dental records. And this is actually to permit and to legalize what has gone on in the profession of dentistry over the last few years is that there are dental practice organizations that will own the physical aspects of the practice but leave the clinical aspects of dentistry totally in the control of dentists, as it should be. And so this was a clarification, and I hope I wanted to alleviate your concerns that because it says any person not licensed by the board, that could include a non-dentist, a non-denturist, but it also could include any citizen, and a licensed denturist. So I don't know. There may be clarification of the two statutes, but I certainly don't think that these changes create a huge barrier to the kind of world that Mr. Davis was describing that he'd like to see happen.
Let me follow up. So, Barney, when it comes to profits, then how is that determined? If the building and all the equipment, et cetera, is owned by Kaiser, by a dentist, by me, what?
They pay rent.
They pay rent? Or how would the profits be determined? Would the owner, whoever the owner was, if it was a physical aspect?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Tomei, in the real world, as I understand it, that would be worked out on a contractual basis between the dentist or dentists. In the case of the Kaiser Permanente Dental Program, there's actually a group dental practice of 150 dentists. There's contract exists between that group and, in our case, Kaiser Foundation Health Plan, regarding the premium that we receive for dental care, how much goes to the dentist for the clinical aspects and how much goes to the health plan for the underlying business aspects, rent, employment of non-dental personnel, et cetera. That's describing our example. I think in other business examples, it would be based on the contract between the practicing dentist or dentists and the others that are party to the operation.
Great. Thanks, Barney. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Thank you, Barney.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Doug.
Chair Cruz, members of the committee, for the record, Doug Barber representing Willamette Dental Group here today in support of Senate Bill 390. As Barney mentioned, this was the product of the interim work group that Willamette Dental was part of with all of the other dental organizations. This bill represents, as Barney said, about 90% of that product, and we support this 90% as well as everybody else, I think. Now, I have heard a rumor that Representative Anderson may be reconsidering his opinion and his position on this and may want to introduce an amendment to this bill. If he does, we'd be happy to support that as well. But if that rumor turns out not to be true, we will support 390 as it stands.
Thank you, Doug. Any questions?
No comment.
Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 390, open a work session, and colleagues, you know, I made a commitment on this, on the very front end of this, that if that really good House bill ran into problems, that almost as good Senate bill would move. And then for some reason we ran into some problems, and I, you know, clearly Representative Bates did not make his case clear enough. But so I was thinking about taking my name off that bill, but what the heck. No, at the end of the day, this is an important legislation. At the end of the day, we wanted to make sure we could move forward with this. And my commitment to all parties was that this bill would remain clean. And we are living up to that commitment. So I would entertain a motion on Senate Bill 390. Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 390 to the floor for the due pass recommendation.
Representative Anderson moves Senate Bill 390 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, clerk, call the roll.
Senator Anderson.
Aye.
Senator Barker.
Excused.
Senator Dalton.
Aye.
Senator
Willis
Anderson.
Aye.
Senator Tomei.
Aye.
Senator Westland.
Excused. Aye. Well, hang on just a minute. Representative Westland wants to vote on 390.
All right.
There
absolutely.
You go. Okay. And Senate Bill 390, having received the required majority, is declared passed. Represent, because of the House bill, I think we should take this to the floor rather than consent, just so people know that we have resolution to the issue. So we'll ask Representative Anderson to carry the bill.
4.5 years.
And Senate Bill 390, having received the required majority, is declared passed. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 390. Thank you very much. And open a public hearing on Senate Bill 470. Cindy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have before us Senate Bill 470A engrossed. It left the Senate floor with a 29-0 vote. One legislative business excused. This prohibits the retaliation by counties against community mental health and developmental disability programs that request mediation, dispute resolution, or files appeals or initiates contested case proceedings to address the contract dispute between the county and the programs. We have before us some dash A4 amendments that we just have received prior to the meeting, and our folks will be speaking to those amendments as well.
Okay, Martin and Sheila.
Oh, I'm sorry. I copied them.
No,
I didn't.
You can't see them.
Chair Cruz, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Martin Taylor, and I'm here today representing the Community Providers Association of Oregon. What you have before you in Senate Bill 470 is one component of a larger concern, which is about the stability of the largely not-for-profit community that provides homes, residential care, or residential facilities for people with developmental disabilities or mental health conditions. As you can imagine, this is a time of great instability, both for the providers of these services and for the counties who take the federal monies to come through the state to the county levels and administer the contracts, both because of the revenue squeeze we're under and because you've got a population that is very vulnerable and facilities that are aging. You've got a squeeze. This is one part of the squeeze, and to be honest, it's not the part of the squeeze that is not one of the solutions that we're most excited about, because it really addresses a problem rather than trying to find some opportunities for a solution. Senate Bill 470 comes to you because in 1997, Senator Fisher helped pass legislation that limited the ability for counties to have additional requirements in their contracts beyond state requirements. Some counties were doing that, and were adding additional expense and creating a great deal of differences in what you were expected to do from one county or the next. That consistency and taking care of that unfunded mandate was a great relief in the counties that proceeded to follow that Senate Bill 141. There was at least one county that didn't immediately change its contracts, and eventually we had providers who took that case through the mediation process and to a state appeal process. As a result of the state appeals process, now that county is complying with Senate Bill 141. The provider that went through that appeals process had their contracts discontinued, and there is some discrepancy between the counties and the providers as to whether that was an act of retaliation or not. I think whether it was an act of retaliation or not, it certainly sent the message to the provider community to tread carefully. There is a legitimate fear or a chilling effect on providers in pursuing mediation and a state appeal, and this bill is intended to remedy at least that condition. I think this bill will greatly relieve providers in feeling like they can pursue legal remedies if they found contracts they felt weren't in compliance with state law. I have with me today two things. There were several other concepts on trying to address the broader issue of stability that go to more positive situations, like is there a way to create some financial stability? Is there a way to create some consistency over time in the kind of contracts that providers have? And these dash amendments are really not completely ready for your review for a couple of reasons. We're on a tight timeline. We just got these amendments back. We believe that these amendments should have sign off from Senator Fisher, who's the chief sponsor of Senate Bill 470, the counties, and then Jerry Crummell, who's the sponsor of these amendments and hasn't had an opportunity to see them, so we'd like Representative Crummell to have a chance to review them. We do want to talk a little bit about the lack of stability in the provider community so that you understand why it might be useful to have some other concepts brought into Senate Bill 470. And for that, I've also brought you Sheila Barker, who's one of my clients.
Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Sheila Barker, and I'm here again for Community Providers Association of Oregon, but I'm also the executive director of Spruce Villa. CPAO is a professional association of residential and employment providers, and we assist approximately 600 individuals with developmental disabilities in the state to have better lives. The majority of our businesses are governed by community boards as not-for-profit companies or corporations, and it's customary for our public testimony to focus on the needs of clients. But today it's going to be a little bit out of character in that today I'm going to be trying to give you a better picture of the effect of the economy and other things on the stability of providers in the state. First of all, I want you to have handy the handouts or the graphs that I have provided you, because I'll be referring to them throughout my testimony. These are tough times for all Oregonians, and our businesses face many of the same challenges as any other in this economy. There are costs that are rapidly eating away at our ability to provide quality services. The first graph you have shows the insurance trends that Spruceville has been experiencing over the last 5 years. I thought this was good when I first looked at it and put it together, but I found out last week that we've been denied renewal of our coverage. So now we're out shopping trying to fix that small problem. But we have been experiencing about a $20,000 a year jump in our insurance costs, not including health. The biggest areas have been workers' compensation and liability, but we've also had increases in home, auto, flood, just like everyone else since the 9/11 disaster. The second graph I have for you talks about utility costs. You all know that utility costs have gone up. But on the graph, I'm showing you a comparison of some things we can have some impact on and some things we just have to pay. Our graph shows that our electricity, fuel, heating has gone up in cost, but at the same time, we've found that we can do some reductions in food. That doesn't mean we're starving our clients. But it is a place where we have some discretion, so we do what we have to do to make sure there's heat. Wages and the turnover of our staff has always been a concern for us. On the third graph, I have information regarding that. You think that an unemployment rate of 7.3% would have people clamoring for work. But the reality is our workforce falls into either highly skilled workers or low-wage workers. The highly skilled include the registered nurses, where there is a massive shortage, and what we can offer them in wages is still below market. The staffing trends graph also shows you that over the 5-year period, we've been able to reduce our turnover rates in our staff, which is a really good thing for stability for the people that we serve. It's much more comfortable to have someone that you know assisting you with your bathing day after day after day than to have someone new come in day after day after day. But as you can see, our vacancy rates, the pink line, has gotten worse, which means we have positions open that we can't fill, even though the people that are coming in are spinning out less frequently. On the fourth graph, you'll see that we've been able to increase wages. We've been able to do that mostly because of actions by the legislature in increasing wages for people that are serving people with developmental disabilities. But over time, on the fifth graph, you see that the percentage of increase has been declining while the cost of, or the consumer price index has been fairly stable. So at this point, the people who are being paid are not keeping up with the costs. So in essence, they're losing money by working for us. The work that we do is hard, and a lot of people aren't willing to do this sort of work, not work that hard for $9 an hour. It's a whole lot easier to flip burgers. So the big difference between our industries and others is we can't raise our prices. Unlike skilled nursing facilities or other kinds of 24-hour client services, we have no fee-for-service clients. There are no private long-term insurance policies for people with developmental disabilities, and they can't save up or earn a living. About 100% of the money that we get comes from the state or other governmental sources, and that's not increasing. In the face of these rising costs, we lost our COLA. I understand why, but it doesn't make it any easier. Some of the providers in residential care are going to be going out of business if these trends continue. One could say that that is just a fact of the marketplace, but in our case, where will the clients go? They can't take care of themselves. It's really hard to imagine growth from other providers to pick up these clients when they're having the same difficulties that we are. We're at a point where we can't afford high-needs people. And since our clients are getting older and our facilities are getting older, the costs of both increase over time. I'm not trying to be overdramatic, but it is difficult. I know you are in between a rock and a hard place, too. You just need to know what we're doing. I support the community model that the state created to facilitate the closure of Fairview. It launched many not-for-profit organizations like my own, and it provides opportunities for clients that had been out of their reach. But as the legislature continues to cripple the service and we don't get more stable, we may have done these folks a disservice by making it more likely that they're going to lose their homes, homes that they may have lived in for 30 years, than if they were under the direct care of the state.
Just wanted to conclude briefly. I think there are some ideas that we'd like to return to you with in these amendments, but we want to do our homework first, go talk to the other folks that need to be involved in drafting amendments. I would say back to the original bill of 470 that we very much appreciate the work of Senator Fisher and Senator Shields as the co-sponsors of this bill, and the counties deserve a great deal of credit. They weren't very enthusiastic about the original version of Senate Bill 470. Working with them, we made a lot of concessions on that first bill. We took punitive damages out of the bill. We changed it from a 7-year statute of limitations to a 2. We gave prevailing party attorney fees as opposed to just having the plaintiff recover attorney fees. We brought that bill into the normal tort process, and we narrowed the causes for retaliation. We did those things because we believe the county has worked with us in good faith, and we hope that we can have that same process at looking at the larger picture, creating some stability that both the counties and the providers of these services need right now. It's a tough time. Open to questions.
Questions. Representative Mona Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have the amendment. Let's look at the amendment, Section 5. Mm-hmm. First of all, where does the money come to provide to pay the providers? Mm-hmm. Is that state fund or Medicaid or?
There's federal Medicaid money that comes. There's a state enhancement. It then goes to the counties where sometimes, depending on the county, there's an enhancement or an administrative cost. It can go either way. And then it goes to provider contracts.
That's correct.
Okay. So what Section 5 really does is the rate of reimbursement is based sort of on the COLA, and if this comes out of DHS money?
Yes. It's run through DHS.
So if we're cutting DHS, that's the section I would have problems with.
Sure. First off, the amendments are probably not really ready to spend a lot of time discussing because we haven't walked them through everyone. The concept is that it would start in 2005. You should know that 17 in the last 21 years, there has been a COLA. There wasn't last year. It was originally budgeted for and taken away in one of the special sessions. We don't anticipate a COLA in the next 2 years. By 2005, you'll have seen these groups go 3 years without a COLA in the light of spiking insurance, spiking energy costs, and other things. The legislature, as you'll see in those amendments, has the ability any time to decide not to give a COLA. It's completely within your authority, but the concept would be to initiate a COLA as part of the budgeting process that comes from the governor's budget, and if there was a tough time, the legislature would take it back, which you have the authority to do. But it starts with a different budgeting assumption. The budgeting assumption would start with the idea that COLA should be built in if you want your not-for-profit industry that provides these services to survive.
Any other questions, Representative?
Martin, obviously you started out with being concerned about retaliation for an incident. Now, all of this is absolutely new to me, so some incident that must have happened in some county.
Right.
So it started out regarding retaliation, and then you've gone to reimbursement with you, this amendment. Tell me how you progressed to that.
There was initially a package of bills that dealt with how to create some stability in this part of the process when communities are closed down and bills are coming from other chambers. If there's a relating clause that might help you get to some of the other measures, you look to it. And that's really what's going on here, that there is a broader issue of stability. And to be honest, the retaliation is a relatively small component of it. It's an important component, but it's a smaller component of the stability of an industry that we count on to provide critical services for folks, and it's in a lot of jeopardy right now.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Paul. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties. The A. and Gross version of Senate Bill 470 was a very carefully crafted compromise. We not only didn't like the original printed bill, we vehemently opposed the original printed bill. And we worked with Mr. Taylor and his clients in developing the A. and Gross version. And with those amendments, we became neutral on the bill. We did have some conversations with the proponents about what I understood to be a potential change. I think the best way to characterize where we are right now is that there's been a miscommunication between the proponents and the counties as to what the proposed amendments would do and where that leaves us. We've had a conversation in the hall, and we have promised to run these by our attorneys and also by our county departments in a couple of affected counties, and we'll do that. But in reading carefully through the amendments, I anticipate some problems. Maybe they won't materialize, but that's my sense of it. And I think Mr. Taylor has appropriately said that we need to have some conversations about the dash four amendments before we bring them back to
the Yeah, Paul, in my conversation with Mr. Taylor yesterday, we knew that we probably would not have had time to have full vetting of these. I do not want to jeopardize the original bill because it is a hard-fought piece of work. And so it's my intention that if consensus can be reached on the dash fours or whatever iteration comes out of that, I would be happy to include them. If consensus can't be reached, I intend to move the original bill. So that's my position, and Martin, I think, will make very sure that counties are involved, Senator Fisher, Senator Shields, all the people who were involved in the original bill will be at the table, or at least to have a chance to weigh in on it. So I'm going to leave it to your good auspices to see what can be worked out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any questions? Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 470. Obviously, it will be coming back at a future date. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 723. Sandy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 723A engrossed comes from the Senate with a 27-1 vote. It allows the Department of Human Services or certain health organizations to recommend that the dispensing pharmacist or individual receiving the health benefits can divide certain prescription medications as a condition for coverage or reimbursement. It prohibits DHS or an organization from imposing coverage or reimbursement restrictions or penalties when a pharmacist and a prescribing physician opposes the recommendation. It declares an emergency upon passage. We have the A3 amendments, which are changing the language of prescribing physician to prescribing practitioner before us. This has no fiscal or revenue impact.
Tom. morning.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good morning. Tom Holt from the Oregon State Pharmacists Association. Senate Bill 723 is a pretty straightforward piece of legislation, as Sandy described. What it actually does is clarify that payers and health plans can recommend that a medication be split. The reason they do that is because in the marketplace there are sometimes different strengths of the same medication that are exactly the same price. So sometimes it might make sense for cost savings to split, say, a 50 milligram tablet in half and get the same result as a 25 milligram and stretch out the money a little ways. The problem, however, is that there are lots of patients out there who are not well equipped to handle split tablets for a variety of reasons. They might have dexterity issues, they might have memory problems, things of that nature that just result in confusion about what dose they're taking when. And so thus the bill, which removes the problem of blanket mandates for pill splitting from the payers, which tends to come through at the pharmacy level, and so that it's very clear that the pharmacist and the prescriber are the ones who make the decision of what's best for patient safety in this case. The language that's before you was the result of discussions on the Senate side, involved a wide variety of people, was mainly drafted with assistance from Regents Blue Cross, but we had input from OMAP and Kaiser, Care Oregon, and a number of others on the Senate side. So that's the result of what we have here. The question you might ask is, why do we need to have the pharmacist involved here if the physician can make the decision on his own about whether or not the patient should be using split tablets? And the answer is really quite simple. Often this takes place in the system, at least initially, without the physician being immediately aware. The signal comes through the system to choose a divided medication where the physician is writing for a particular dosage strength. And a pharmacist is the person in the best position to monitor ongoing whether a patient is able to be compliant with half tablets. They'll see when they come in on refills, are they coming in at the right time and things of that nature, so that the red flags that may come up in this are going to happen at the pharmacy level. The way the language is crafted, we're ensuring that there is communication between the pharmacist and the prescriber so that everyone knows what's going on with the patient. And the bottom line being, do what's best for the patient. And if we can use tablet splitting to save dollars to the system when the patient can handle it, by all means, let's do that. But when the patient is not a good candidate for that, we don't want the conflict between everyone's desire to save costs in the system to override patient safety. And with that, I'd be happy to take questions.
Questions? Representative Moss Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Usually if a person can't take his pills appropriately or split them, the physician should know immediately. I would think that the pharmacist shouldn't. That would be more of a medical care issue rather than the pharmacist just determining some a different medication in which the pill wouldn't have to be split.
Chair Cruz, Representative Monis Anderson, I would agree with that. The issue here is when a particular strength has been written, and then through the payment system you get a signal at the pharmacy to divide that in half, and it may the original prescriber would not have necessarily written half tablets, but they may have written 50 milligrams or 25 milligrams, and the result is that there is a move to split without the original prescriber having had input on that at the beginning.
Couldn't, though, a pharmacist then, I know this is pharmacists are never ingenious, disingenuous, but choose the more expensive drug for profit reasons.
Chair Cruz, Representative Monis Anderson, in this case, we're talking about where there be medications at the same price in the marketplace. That's the only reason you would split if the medication of the same strengths or different strengths are at the same price. So there would be no cost incentive there for the pharmacist to choose one strength over another.
Any questions? Thank you, Tom. Jeff.
Good morning, members of the committee, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jeff Hetherington. I'm the Executive Director for the Osteopathic Physicians and Surgeons of Oregon. I'm also the President of Family Care, Inc., which is an Oregon health plan contractor. We are here testifying in opposition to this bill, and I'll give you a little history on the issue. A number of health plans started doing pill splitting when they found that as was testified to earlier, sometimes double the strength is the same cost or only 20% more than say, a unit cost of something that's half. So what we have gotten into the position of doing as a health plan, and what our physicians certainly have bought into, is that when the patient can split a pill and when it does save money for the system, that they will prescribe say 20 milligrams, for instance, of Lipitor, and ask the patient to split it down to 10. You also have some situations where the dosages, quite frankly, aren't in the strengths that the patient needs. So you might have a 50 milligram tablet and the patient only needs 25, and they would do that kind of pill splitting also. In every insurance company and every Oregon health plan managed care plan, if pill splitting is in the formulary, there is also an exception process whereby the physician can say, in the interest of the patient, whatever their condition is, you can ask for an authorization to give them whatever dosage is appropriate without having to do the pill splitting. The other thing that's important here is that if a physician writes for, let's say, 10 milligrams of Lipitor and our formulary calls for pill splitting on 20, neither the pharmacist nor the health plan can do anything without the physician's permission. So if the pharmacist cannot, for instance, default to the formulary without they can't change the physician's prescription. So the comment that was made that inadvertently the patient would be caught in the middle is not accurate. Because for the pharmacist to change what's written on the prescription, they have to get permission from the doctor to do that. And we can't override, that just by having a rule. The problem we have seen, both from the physician side and the health plan side, is a number of pharmacists say to the patient, gee, I can make it much more convenient for you by just giving you the single dose. And then they either call the physician or they call the health plan. And that in and of itself, starts a little conversation and just sort of runs up the bill when it's not necessary. And in some cases upsets the patient. The bill now, originally it said that pill splitting was subject to a $10,000 fine. But what it says now is a pharmacist or a physician may decide that pill splitting is not in the best interest of the patient if pill splitting is not within the standards of the practice of pharmacy or the practice of medicine. And that's on lines 8 through 11 on the bill. And from the point of view of our physicians, we do not understand why a physician would have to be concerned about, what the practice of pharmacy requires. Frankly, the physicians don't want to get the phone calls and be put in the middle between the pharmacist and the patient. We believe the patient safety controls are there. As Representative Bonus Anderson said, you know, the physician is the one that makes the prescription. The physician knows the condition of the patient, and that's we think that the patient is served by the physician, and that's where it ought to stay without having a whole new layer now of debate between our pharmacist and a physician as to, you know, whether or not their prescription is appropriate.
Questions? Thank you very much. Committee will suspend at ease for now. Convene the committee. We got a quorum again now. Thank you very much. After taking the temperature of the committee anonymously, but very publicly at the same time, we seem at this point in time to have a constitutional problem with this bill. So, and I'm not sure what the resolution is going to be, but at this point I'm going to close the public hearing. We will not go into work session because the votes aren't here. And seeing no further business, we are adjourned.